Okay, Sarah and I decided this is enough to get going. Most of us are here, so we'll go ahead and start. Yeah, quorum. We didn't do a count, actually. But. Okay, so if folks can take their seats, we'll get started here. So, again, thanks for those of you who were able to get onto the call on April 30th for the web call. This is Alice Lind. I'm the chair, and I'm just going to get us kicked off this morning, and then we'll go around and do introductions of everybody. Thanks for those of you who were able to start to participate on the April 30th web meeting. We're going to cover a little bit of that ground again today, so if you missed the April 30th meeting, not all is lost. We are hoping that all of you noticed that you had homework assignments tucked into the material that was sent out to you by Sarah last week, and so if you didn't pick up on that when I call your name, don't faint. There were at least two people assigned to each assignment, so maybe your colleague will cover for you while you scramble and look through the large tables of measures. And good morning.
Good morning, Alice.
In the web meeting, we started introducing the whole, like, transitioning from the work that we've been doing into this new family of measures idea, and we'll, again, cover the basics of that for those of you who need that refreshed. I think I can zip through it in 10 minutes now that I've done it a couple of times. Cheryl Powell, who's here again today, talked at our web meeting about the importance of this work, and so we're really happy that Cheryl's here in person today. If any of you want to pester her for any additional comments about why it is so important for you to have taken 2 days out of your lives plus the travel time, Cheryl will give you the talking points for that. We have in the online materials, the full biographies of the folks on the work group. We have a few new members that we introduced during the web meeting. So Gwendolyn Burr is the new representative from the American Medical Directors Association. Administration on Community Living has replaced representatives, and today we have Sean Terrell with us. And then Lisa Patton is the new rep from SAMHSA. So as we go around, we'll make sure and make sure that they know who the rest of you are. We have two new subject matter experts that were confirmed last week by the NQF board, and that's Dr. Nancy Hanrahan, an expert in care coordination, and Dr. Ruth Perry, an expert in Medicaid accountable care organizations. So we'll go ahead at this point and just start, if you don't mind, Sarah. I'll start. I'm Alice Lind again, the chair. Sarah?
Sarah Lash, NQF staff.
I'm Gwen Boer. I'm representing the American Medical Directors Association, and I'm a geriatrician. I work at Duke University.
Thanks. Hi, I'm Clark Ross. I work for the American Association on Health and Disability, and I represent the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities, the National Disability Policy Coalition here with the National Quality Forum.
Good morning. I'm Laura Linnebach with LA Care Health Plan, representing LA Care Health Plan.
Good morning. I'm George Andrews. I'm a physician cardiologist, and I'm Humana's Corporate Chief of Quality.
Hi, I'm Joan Zlotnick, and I am representing the National Association of Social Workers, and I am with the National Association of Social Workers. Okay. Susan Reinhart. I direct the AARP Public Policy Institute. I am a community health nurse by background, and I'm here not representing AARP, but of course I always am. And I am, I think I'm here as a home and community-based services expert.
Hi, I'm Cheryl Powell from CMS.
I'm Dr. Ruth Perry. I'm the executive director of the Trenton Health Team, which is an organization based in Trenton, New Jersey, that's working to become a Medicaid ACO.
Thanks. Welcome.
Hi, Tom Clark from CAMHSA representing Lisa Patton.
Good morning, Steve Council. I'm a geriatrician at Wishart Health Services, Safety Net Hospital in Indianapolis, and also at Indiana University. I'm representing the National Association of Public Hospitals and Health Systems.
Mady Chalk, I'm Director of Policy Research at Treatment Research Institute. I'm a subject matter expert in substance use disorders.
Hi, I'm Maggie Nigren. I'm the Executive Director of the American Association on Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities, AAIDD, and I'm representing AAIDD.
Thanks, Maggie. Good morning. I'm Juliana Preston, Executive Director of Health Insight. I'm here as a subject matter expert on measure methodology.
Good morning. I'm Deb Potter from the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. And full disclosure, I also report that 2 days a week I'm on detail to the Office of the Secretary for planning and evaluation in the Disability Aging and Long-Term Care Policy Group.
Good morning. I'm Jim Dunford. I'm a professor emeritus in emergency medicine at the University of California, San Diego, and I'm also the City of San Diego Medical Director, and I'm here as a subject matter expert in emergency medical services.
Good morning. Leonardo Cuello with the National Health Law Program, and I'm here on behalf of my organization as a consumer advocate for dual eligibles.
My name is Sean Terrell from the Administration for Community Living. I'm here sitting in for Marisa Scalafoli.
Good morning. I'm Tom Vallis, the Senior Vice President for Strategic Partnerships at NQF, which includes the Measure Applications Partnership. And I want to also welcome the new members and thank the continuing members for the hard work that you all have put in. And I particularly want to thank Alice for the direction that she provides to us in between these meetings, we're so grateful for, and also Cheryl for the guidance and sponsorship for this work.
Thanks, Tom. Operator, are there work group members on the phone that could be introduced?
You have Ann Cohen.
Oh, Ann, good. Ann, do you want to go? Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Yes, I'm Ann Cohen. I'm a disability and a health policy consultant, and I am your disability MAP expert. And I oppose if I can't be there in person. I'm scheduled to have a baby this week.
If you need to break away suddenly, that will be understandable.
If you need great help, then, you know.
Thanks, Ann.
And we have Daniel online as well.
Oh, Daniel, go ahead.
Dan Tidlaham with Veterans Health Administration.
Thank you.
Mental health group.
Great. Okay. Don't hesitate to pipe up Ann and Dan. We just wanted to refresh everybody's memory about the timeline and where we're at right now. As you noticed in the April meeting, we have moved beyond phase one now. Phase two saw the completion of the interim report that was published in December, and we're just now into this July part of your work group timeline showing that we're going to start working in these two specific areas today and tomorrow, behavioral cognitive subgroups and talking about the family of measures for dual eligible beneficiaries. Hopefully you all have kept up okay with that transition, and if not, you'll just poke us if you have questions about it. If you remember, this phase that we're, this couple of day meeting is leading to an interim report that will be very technical in nature. So we wanted to make sure that this couple of days is really focused heavily in measures. If you remember, those of you who were participating in the last year's work, we did a lot of work in kind of subgroups, and we brought in a lot of didactic kind of talks for various subject matter topics. And this time we're going to do most of the work all together in one big group, and we'll see how that works for all of you. If you all feel like you are getting adequate time to voice opinions and whatnot. And if not, then come and see Sarah and I at the end of today, because we'll, you know, we can have a little regrouping if it's not working. But the convention in the meeting is that if you need to speak, just put your nameplate up and let me know, and we'll be a little less formal today as we're getting new folks oriented to the work of the group and starting to work through some of this really hard technical stuff. So if that works for everybody, we'll just get going. We will have a more detailed report too that's coming out after the July kind of technical stuff is published, and that will have a more formal public comment opportunity for folks. Today's meeting objectives, again, are to identify potential measures for use with high-need behavioral cognitive subgroups, to discuss related activities and implications for applying measures that relies heavily on all of your participation to talk about, too. Consolidate the measures identified for high-need beneficiaries with what we used to call the evolving core set, and now that will emerge into this new construct called the family of measures for dual eligible beneficiaries. By the end of tomorrow, we'll have finalized all of our meeting themes and talk about what's going to go forward as action items for HHS. Ready? Okay, here we'll see if I can do this really speedy quick like I picture myself being able to do. So, just to refresh, why are we constructing this family of measures? The family of measures is a way for us to put different measures that we have pre-screened together that work on a given topic. Our topic, obviously, is the dual eligible population. Each of the other MAP subgroups has published such families of measures, and they tend to be more like studying specific or provider specific or whatever. Ours is going to have a little different flavor because we're looking at a population, but the construct still seems to work, and you'll have to tell us what if there's any parts of it that don't work for you. In our case, we are definitely transcending the specific healthcare service location or the specific type of provider as we put this together. So we have a framework already established. We have started pulling together the inventory of measures, which you'll start seeing in your hands today in your electronic version and a hard copy version. And the steps that we'll go through over the next couple of days are reviewing measures and selecting the best ones available, defining the measure family of measures, and identifying gaps. And so as we put this family together, that's one of the really important things to know, is that there just will not be a perfect measure for every part of this construct. I think we've all started to experience that already. So here is our couple of building slides. As you recall, we started off with this kind of starter set of measures that were identified in the first year. We have built on that over time to focus on the needs of complex older adults and younger adults with physical disabilities. We are replacing this idea of a starter set or a core with this new idea of a family of measures. It looks so pretty in color, doesn't it? Mine don't show up like this on my printed version. And over these next couple of days, really focusing in on the needs of people with serious mental illness, substance abuse disorders, intellectual or developmental disabilities, and cognitive impairments. That's quite a lot for 2 days of work, which this is why we're like zipping through this intro stuff. If you recall, this is this kind of almost Rubik's Cube kind of picture of measures. Each row corresponds to a high leverage opportunity topic area. Each square represents a measure. So as you pull these together, they could get you little groups of measures that are perfect for your use. That's the goal here anyway, is that if you have a subpopulation of people just in nursing home with cognitive disorders, that you would be able to pull the cognitive measures and the people in nursing home measures and create your own little provider set. Or similarly, that you could pull the measures that are usable for health plans and create a little set that's perfect for that. This outline shows that there's, you know, this example of subsets of those measures that apply to the complex older adults. This one shows here is a little group of measures, again, with our high priority items over on the right and outlined in red, all the handful of measures that apply best to younger folks with physical disabilities. Obviously, there could be some overlap on those kinds of measures. And again, there could be some that are that fit best in a particular setting, and this slide represents that. All right, now tell me, are we up to this one? So the NQF folks put together this example slide just for you to have a concrete person to think about in this way. So, for example, here is a 65-year-old patient who's on Medicare and Medicaid, both with heart disease, who receives ongoing ambulatory care from a primary care provider. Some of the measures fit best there under, on the primary care side of your chart. Anytime the person's hospitalized, there's a separate set of measures over on the right side of your graphic that apply best to the inpatient setting. If the person moves out of inpatient to a rehab or a home health setting, there's a separate set of measures that apply best there. And so you can see how you can pull different measures and they, you know, looking at it from a person-centered point of view, there's, you know, different measures applied to the person's care depending on where they are in any given point in time, but they all belong to this family of measures. So this was a speedy review of the more in-depth way that we talked about this in the web meeting. So I'm going to pause here and just make sure if anybody has questions about this construct, having now seen it a couple of times. Thinking in.
This is George Andrews. I do have a question. I certainly understand the logic behind having unique measures that apply to a different setting. At the same time, I think that it is critical to ensure that everybody, every stakeholder who's touching the member, as the member moves across the spectrum of care, that if they have measures that are similar, they are all going to be supporting that same measure so that the impact or the result of that measure being successful is going to be much higher. So I'm just throwing that out. As something to consider during these deliberations.
Thank you. You know, one of the things that we talked about in the very early part of this group was trying to get away from, you know, especially lifting up from the disease-specific measures or the setting-specific measures just for that very reason, is because we were, you know, if you're looking at a population as opposed to a setting of care, it is that much more incumbent on all of us to think about how the measures interact with each other, how the different settings interact with each other, how does the transition of care look at the whole person, and how the handoffs happen, much more important than if we were just looking at a single setting. So thanks.
You're right on, George, with what we're ultimately trying to get to. What we're starting with is that we currently have siloed payment programs across the settings. And instead of just defaulting to that, what we've tried to do is still meet that need, because we need those accountability measures for the evolving Medicare and now Medicaid programs that use performance measures. But this model is meant to, at a certain level, have the family of related measures in the way that Alice was describing, so that we can move from just the setting-specific or at least use measures in the setting-specific program that are related at some level. Ultimately, we'd like to get to measures in the family that are very much more closely related in the way that you described, and that would be what we're aiming to accomplish over time. But as we know, we don't have those measures yet. number one. And number two, the measures that you would want at different levels of analysis from the provider perspective or at different care settings from the patient perspective aren't always necessarily exactly the same. So that's why we use this concept of related measures across those levels of analysis and setting. We're not as related as we want to be yet, but this is the first step.
Any other comments before we move on or questions, especially about the family of measures construct? Sarah.
Okay. We have just a few slides to reintroduce the high-need subgroups for today's conversation and to remind you about some key issues that could be impacted through the use of measures. So we have put four different groups together today. They have many things in common, but many things that are unique to each of them. We'll be looking at measures available for individuals with serious mental illness, substance use disorders, and even some measures for milder substance use that might not get to the disorder level. Individuals who have some type of acquired cognitive impairment, such as you might have with dementia or stroke, and then also persons with intellectual or developmental disabilities. And we'll be sort of walking through the first half of this SHAPE first, the SMI and SUD groups. This afternoon, we'll be doing the cognitive impairment and IDD folks. And then we'll be looking at measures which really would apply to anyone on this slide first thing tomorrow morning. On the web meeting, we shared some key issues that can be impacted to improve the quality of care in our five high-leverage opportunity areas that have been well established over the course of this work. We just want to sort of show these once more to refresh your memory, but also to highlight where folks provided input to us after the web meeting, and we've made some changes. So basically the function of the key issues was to be our search terms when looking for measures. And so this was a really important input to shape the large table of measures that you received to review. So on the quality of life slide, we have edited the issue of social engagement and involvement in meaningful activities in the IDDD subgroup column. On care coordination and safety, we added the use of seclusion to several subgroups as a quality issue, and the avoidance of anticholinergic medications and home safety and environment for the dementia and acquired impairment subgroup. Under screening and assessment, we added caregiver burden and burnout for something that might need to be periodically screened and assessed. This is a common issue across these high-need subgroups. We also added implications for the treatment of asthma, sleep disorders, and other conditions, as well as pain management for the substance use disorder subgroup, and added superimposed delirium, psychosis, or sleep disturbance, as well as driving risk for the dementia and acquired impairment subgroup. Under mental health and substance use, we didn't have any updates here. We'll be going through the stated areas in greater detail. And there were also no updates to the structural measure issues. These are, again, cross-cutting because of their nature as structural measures. So as I said, with these issues functioning as search terms, we scanned the NQF portfolio of endorsed measures and consulted with a few external sources for relevant measures we know that are in use. We tagged and organized them by many factors to make them a little bit easier to review, and we found more measures than we anticipated actually going into this. We thought the gap areas would be particularly dominant, and though we still have many gaps, there are over 100 measures that relate to these issues and these topic areas. So the staff looked critically at what we found and took the perspective that this group has
developed over time as you've continued to meet, and we made some initial prioritizations. So I see a lot of laptops out. Thank you for that. Now is the time to pull up the measure table. If you'd like to borrow one from NQF, we have a few spares as well as a few printouts of the measure table. If you're a hard copy person, you can raise your hand and the staff will assist. Give you just a second. So if you're in the electronic version, we're in tab 2. Okay. And each row in this table is a single measure. There's many, many rows, but we're going to take them in chunks. And each column is a little bit color-coded for ease of navigation. So measures basic information, its NQF number and endorsement status, its title and its type, those are in gray. If MAP has weighed in on a measure in the past, if it's one of the other families of measures or this group has put it in the core set, that's noted in the blue column. The measure specifications have a red heading. Those are the numerator, the denominator, the level of analysis, and so on. And all the way over to the right, if you scroll over, there's a lot of information about how the measure is used, if that's the case, if it applies to a national quality strategy priority, federal Medicare payment or incentive program, the Medicaid adult core set, special needs plan measure reporting requirement, whether it's in one of the state demonstrations that has published a memorandum of understanding, or even if it's used in a private purchaser incentive program. And it's ordered from top to bottom by topic area. Column G, F and G, if you're looking at it in Excel. And in column G, we've done a little bit of highlighting of staff picks. These are the measures that seem particularly strong to us based on the different factors that I just sort of walked through. Other cells are highlighted here and there to show alignment opportunities. And these are really just a starting point for discussion. It's up to this group to, you know, agree or disagree with that initial prioritization, but we thought, given the volume of measures here, we wanted to direct the conversation just a little bit. You can hide the columns that you're not interested in just to make it a little bit easier to get through on your computer screen, and we'll take this slowly. We want to make sure that people don't feel rushed. So today's product, what we're thinking we're going to have at the end of the day, is a measure table with some number of rows and some decision about whether that measure is good for all of the behavioral and cognitive subgroups or some subset of them. We have some initial tags for those as well in the far left columns of your spreadsheet. So this is, you know, almost an intermediate step on the way to conducting or compiling the full family of measures tomorrow. We really are thinking about the mental illness, the substance use disorders, the cognitive impairment, and the IDDD factors today. So we'll be going through topic by topic and making various judgments.
I think we're ready to go.
All right, so raise your hand if you need help with the either finding the table or orienting yourself. You need the paper copy because we're going to plunge in and start doing the work now. It's kind of early. Do you need to stand up and get more coffee before we start? It's kind of early.
Actually, no. It's not that technical of a rating. That's just a tool we use to sort the spreadsheet from top to bottom so that the row numbers would be preserved. So everything in group one is of equal weight unless it's highlighted that darker purple that indicates a stack pick, but those would 1.1 and 1.2 are equivalent.
Okay, that was your last call for getting up and getting caffeine if you needed it. Here we go. So we have 50 measures to review for the SMI and substance use disorders high need subgroup. You should have your tables now sitting in front of you so you know like what the range of measures was in this group. We're going to start off by having Sarah walk through the staff picks. I feel like we're at like a video store, wine store or something. So the staff picks, no, because of their robust flavor.
It wasn't as much fun as selecting wines out.
Yeah, perhaps not. So, depends on how geeky you are, I guess. So, Sarah.
All right. So I'll share a little bit of background about how we arrived at each group of staff picks, and then we want to hear from you if you have any questions or disagreements with those picks. You know, it needs to be good for the high-need behavioral and cognitive subgroups noted on the far left. If you have changes to those subgroups or would recommend that a measure that a staff picked not be moved forward or that a measure not picked as by the staff should be elevated and moved forward, we'll go in groups and everyone will have a chance to weigh in during group discussion, but we'll first turn to the two people who are assigned in each topic area. So Susan and Mady, stand by. You're up first.
I have to tell you, I only got access to this last night and did not see this assignment.
All right. So we'll take care of it in the group then. We have seven measures related to tobacco use as our first topic. And the staff picks are two of the seven. They're NQF number 0028 and NQF number 0027. Measure 28 is currently in the evolving core measure set and the starter set. It's been previously selected for the fact that it includes both screening and counseling for tobacco use.
Sarah, sorry to ask a question. Tobacco use. What are we analyzing it towards? In other words, are we looking at some specific subpopulation? I mean,
mm-hmm.
So what I mean is, are we looking at it for review under all of these at the same time? So, tobacco use for what?
Tobacco. I would say is a risk factor for a number of groups. We attached it to serious mental illness, substance use disorders, and the cognitive impairment populations in particular.
Right. So we're measuring tobacco use towards all of the mm-hmm. risk areas that we've identified?
Yes.
Within duals?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that I was thinking about the right question.
Okay. And so Measure 28 is in the cardiovascular and diabetes families of measures. It applies to a number of care settings, including behavioral health providers. It has a number of ways that it promotes alignment. It's in use in the Meaningful Use Program for health professionals, the Medicare Shared Savings Program for ACOs, and the Physician Quality Reporting System for individual clinicians. It's been selected by the Massachusetts state demonstration, and it's in use in at least one Beacon community and is a core ambulatory measure for the buying value program. Measure 27 is similar, medical assistance with smoking and tobacco use cessation. This is a patient-reported outcome and a high-impact condition measure. The measure includes advising smokers to quit, discussing the cessation medications, different methods and strategies. This also is in use in a number of other programs, including Medicaid Adult Set, Meaningful Use Again, and the Physician Quality Reporting System Again. So there are five other measures in tobacco that were perceived as slightly less strong, but we will now open up for discussion if there is agreement or disagreement about these two measures as the best available for tobacco use.
So the second one, that's the survey-based measure, is that are those add-on questions to CAP? Yeah? Thanks, Laura. Maddie, go ahead.
We were just doing a sidebar conversation about why the tobacco seems not to be applied to the intellectual IDDD population.
It hadn't come up as a key issue there, that there isn't a known risk for tobacco use in that population, but it certainly could be. We could make it across the board.
I strongly suggest that we put it across the board. I don't know whether Clark has a different opinion, but I'd be curious.
No, I don't have a different opinion. I was thinking this afternoon we're having two experts present the national core indicators and the personal outcome measures, and that would be the kind of question I would think we would ask this afternoon's IDDD expert panel on how they factored in tobacco use in the current measures they already have. So, generically, it makes sense to apply it across the board, but they're the experts coming at 12:45.
Okay, thanks.
Primarily because there is a big difference between this kind of screening and getting advice about tobacco use and alcohol or illicit drugs. They're not, for a variety of reasons, they're not in the same category. There is no level of tobacco use that we know, at least scientifically, that is good. Alcohol is somewhat different, and illicit drugs we can talk about at another time. But so putting it across all populations makes absolute sense to me.
Thanks. Steve?
Well, this gets at a general question I've had around just process and conceptualizing this. Originally, in past experience, I've gotten the impression we're focusing our recommendations for measures that are particularly specific to the dual eligible population or subgroups, as opposed to something that's generalizable across the whole population. And so do we need to pick out tobacco, for instance, in screening and treatment use as something that's specific to dual eligibles or these subgroups, when it should be covered broadly, throughout, the various measures? That comes up a number of times throughout, so I guess this is a general question.
So just to get pulled back into the context, so if you remember, the beginning work that we did was to say, for dual eligibles, what are the kind of cross-cutting issues, the topics of concern, the high leverage opportunity areas for the population. The task that we're doing now is to say for specific subgroups of the duals, are there best fit measures for those subgroups? And so we had already at least one of these is in our pre-identified core topics of, you know, importance because of, you know, just general population health, et cetera. But we had already identified that tobacco use was a particular concern for the duals. Now that we're going into this particular subgroup, again, it's like the whole, you know, years of life lost for people with serious mental illness and knowing how prominent tobacco use is in that population. Should we highlight it as, you know, if you are enrolling a specific subgroup of duals, like, you know, some of the different models and states are taking a health home approach, only enrolling people with serious mental illness into a particular health home. It's our way of highlighting it to that program. If you are focusing in on the needs of people with serious mental illness, gosh, do we think it's important for you to include a tobacco use measure or two? Sean.
So quick, I just want to make sure I understand. So this is not looking at, or is there an assumption built into this that if you do these things, there'll be an outcome? Like people decrease their smoking, is that assumed, or are we just not really? Is that not? We're just looking at the sort of output question. These people got these services.
So these measures that have been endorsed, we would assume that there is an outcome related to the process measures by virtue of the having gone through NQF endorsement. Yes. Why are you doubtful about that whole ability of the
not necessarily, but I don't know. I wonder if at some point is there an attempt to measure the outcomes directly.
So through the endorsement process that Alice mentioned, there's a hierarchical preference for outcome measures. We don't always have the outcome measures we want. The group can classify those areas as gaps, or the group could accept a process measure, or do both. Say it's a process measure that's somewhat connected to the outcome, but we really want the outcome measure. So those are your options. On this point, Sarah, it might be helpful to go back to your green slide that has the rows and the columns with the check marks, because I think there's still some confusion about what we're trying to construct here, and it goes to both Leo and Steve's points. So first of all, we're trying to populate these rows of measures by picking the best ones that you would want in a family for a specific topic area, like, for example, tobacco. But then you guys are also going to have to help us determine, do we have check marks across the board for all groups, like the first row, or are these measures particularly applicable to certain groups? Because we're trying to answer a set of questions here to get to measures both that apply either broadly or to specific subpopulations.
Quite good.
I did want to explain the significance of tobacco use and serious mental illness. State psychiatric hospitals, until as recently as less than a decade ago, gave away cigarettes and promoted cigarette smoking as a way to fill the day. And so state psychiatric hospitals no longer do that, but in many state psychiatric hospitals right now, today, the only way you get outside is for a smoke break. So you have people who are 21 years old who have never smoked in their life, and they know the only way they can get some sun is to take up smoking. So there's this unique history of the misuse of this product, and so it doesn't argue against expanding it across all the populations, but there's a unique sensitivity, and this is an issue that the SAMHSA Wellness Campaign National Steering Committee has focused on, is tobacco use and how to move away in a healthier lifestyle in a consumer, person-centered way.
That there's also people smoke with psychiatric disabilities often as a result of dealing with the side effects of medication.
Right.
Which, you know, so when you talk about counseling as a way of dealing with, you know, or talking about smoking, just quit smoking, well, there's a whole other piece of work that needs to be done around, like, you know, shared decision making, for instance.
Yeah.
around the medications themselves.
Yeah.
So that's, I don't know if there's a measure for that, but.
Part of CAPS, right? Valerie.
Yeah, Valerie Wilbur with the, representing the SNP Alliance. I had the same question that you had, Steve, at the beginning when I was looking at these measures, if it was just duals or whether it was the specific four subsets that we were dealing with. And I talked to one of my members that represents, that serves people with severe and persistent mental illness as a CSNP. And I was saying, you know, why, when I was looking at the measures that I was responsible to review, I said, you know, why is COPD, for example, one of the conditions that's listed for people with mental illness? And they explained to me that people with mental illness have a number of addictions, not just alcohol and drug use, but also smoking, and that there's a high percentage within this plan that serves as PMI, there's a high percentage of people with COPD, so that it was an important measure, and so smoking cessation would be a very appropriate measure for that particular group. They also told me that some of these group homes use smoking as an incentive to get people to comply with the treatment regimens, which, you know, as the gentleman up the way there was saying, was, you know, obviously a key concern. But the other issue that I wanted to raise right at the beginning of this discussion, since one of the issues is self-report, and I've talked to Lisa Patton and SAMHSA and, you know, Sarah Lash and a number of others about concerns that SNP Alliance members have with self-report for people with mental illness, with, you know, different kinds of behavioral problems, with cognitive impairments. And it's an issue that I hope, you know, can be surfaced over the course of this discussion, because there's a great deal of concern within the plan community about using self-report measures for people that have intellectual cognitive, you know, impairments, and whether the data that are being provided are valid and reliable. And I think, you know, to some extent, it may depend on what environment a person is living in. If you are in a program like a PACE program where you have nurses that are with those people 3 or 4 days a week, they have a pretty good sense of what's going on. They can be, you know, serve as a proxy, probably works pretty well. But in cases where people are either, you know, maybe they're living in a nursing home and the daughter who's their responsible party is far away, they really don't understand what's going on, or if they're in the community, they don't have either family or formal caregiver support, or even the family members might not really be aware of what's going on. I don't know whether any of you read the book by Judith Stein called Bittersweet Season, but she ended up spending, this woman who was taking care of her mother in her later years, spent a lot of time in emergency rooms over the last couple of years because her mom was constantly falling. Mom never told her that she was incontinent, so she'd get up in the middle of the night and be rushing to the bathroom and fall. Well, you know, so there's so much, there's so many factors that account for whether a person that has these impairments are doing are really reporting reliable data, and I just think that that's something we really need to be very, you know, cognizant of over the next 2 days as we're looking at these measures.
Yeah. I mean, there's the issue of recall, too, for any of the survey measures,
sure,
because the look back might be, you know, maybe the doctor, provider, nurse practitioner brings up the issue of smoking once a year, but they don't pester the person on every single visit. Did you quit yet? So, Deb.
Not to beat a horse down. There's also a hesitancy of physicians who are treating people with mental illness or substance abuse to put another thing on the plate, like smoking. And so it also doesn't get discussed in terms of clinical care and how it might impact other health care. So I'd like to throw a proposal out. I think we want tobacco measures to be measured for everybody, but we want them to be reported for the subpopulation of people with serious mental illness and substance abuse separately, so that you can see if there's disparities in care.
Maybe.
I would support that, because we know that the research still, I mean, even in programs for addictions, they are not, programs for alcohol addiction, programs for opiate addiction are not tracking smoking. And we really need to pay attention to that. Yes. Steve?
I'll just follow up. I wanted to clarify that if we don't list it as an important measure, that we're not saying that that's not important to be measured. You know, so.
Right. That's right.
In the DD population. So if we're leaving things off our lists, it doesn't mean that they're not important generally for the population, I guess. I think what I'm hearing and processing is that what we're about is really looking at things that are especially pertinent And if you have to select 24 measures for a dual eligible population, that this is one that you wouldn't want to miss,
yeah.
You know, kind of thing. So we're really prioritizing or identifying measures that should be particularly emphasized or not left out, as opposed to looking at everything that should be measured.
Thanks. Leonardo?
So I think I'm kind of understanding what's going on. And as I look at the measures, what jumps out at me, and so tell me if I sort of am understanding what the NQF staff was thinking. Measures 3, 4, 5, and 6 all seem to apply only in a hospital facility setting, right? So you would be missing a whole swath of people who are not in the system there. Measures 1.7 is just sort of a very general population level measure that wouldn't really give us much data. Measure 2 has the downside of only applying to an ambulatory care setting, whereas the first one, 1.1, seems to get both ambulatory settings, some inpatient settings, although it wasn't clear to me that it gets a lot, but it also would seem to align well with a lot of the BH populations we would worry about, and so that would be sort of the logic behind out of this group prioritizing that one. So I have it sort of right. Am I close to seeing the right thing?
Very close. There's a lot of logic that went into these decisions, and I can talk more about why we didn't pick those other measures. Part of it is having to do with a limited care setting of only inpatient hospital care. In addition, those numbers are currently undergoing endorsement under status that says submitted. And so we aren't able to predict if the Behavioral Health Steering Committee will recommend those to move forward. So we know that the first two measures are fully endorsed. And so given, you know, things that are equal in other areas, we went with measures that are currently endorsed. And you are correct in that 1.7 measure 2020 is at a national or state population level, and we didn't think that was very actionable from a, you know, provider or health plan perspective.
So just so I understand, the on the data source, the first one is sort of claims data, which is great. You can link all this to service utilization, you know, you can scale it up and down across, you can slice it all different ways, which is nice because, you know, the context of counseling or where, how this works in conjunction with other services and how that whole thing is supported throughout, you're talking about people with disabilities, you know, throughout their system is probably going to be really helpful in actually getting to an outcome that you'd want. But, so the second one on the survey, it's a survey question. Does that is it implied that these are survey questions that stand alone, that are not connected to other data systems? Are these done electronically that are connected? Do they collect patient-specific data, you know, that you can link? Mm-hmm. That's sort of the survey, general survey question I have.
It varies depending on the measure and the survey. So this one, this measure is part of the HEDIS set for health plans. So it's not, you know, just an electronic checklist in the doctor's office that goes into a black hole. It's this one is designed to contribute to a larger data set.
But on the other hand, doesn't connect back to, like, the provider setting where the provider would know that the person said, no, nobody's ever counseled me about smoking, right? I mean, like, you would know, like, of the people you're responsible for, if you did it at the provider level, you might get results back that say, you know, 50% of the people who smoke say that you never counseled them about smoking, but it wouldn't say Joe Smith was not counseled, so you better... Right. It's not like a health risk assessment kind of a survey. Right.
That's the case with most of the measures here, that you can't pick them back down to the individual very easily. They're in aggregated data sets for the most part.
One last comment. The reason this particular version of the measure is important to me is that it is in HEDIS. Now, the experience with HEDIS to date in terms of moving behavioral health measures has been very poor. It hasn't happened. The measures don't move. They don't improve. The more we can, whether this is the dual eligibles group or other NQF measures groups, the more we can elevate these kinds of measures to various, to the plan level's attention and to the provider level, the more we can hope that it will, they will begin to have some impact on behavior.
Yeah. Ruth?
I guess I have some newbie questions, so I apologize for that. But I think from an Medicaid ACO perspective, this is a comment, the process metrics are important, but we need outcome metrics because really we're trying to manage with the triple aim of improving health outcomes, lowering costs, and a better care experience for the patient. So I just want to lift that up for the group to think about from that ACO perspective. Outcomes are very important. The first question that I have are we assuming that these family of metrics will fit all populations? Because when you think of Trenton is the capital of New Jersey, it's urban, it's extremely poor, 36% of the individuals live below the 200% federal poverty line, a lot of racial and ethnic diversity, low levels of education, huge number of individuals that are homeless. And so when you begin to look specifically at tobacco or some of these disease metrics, and they are important as a physician, no doubt, we should be asking everybody, do they smoke? But the flip side of this is when people are confronted with survival issues every day, quitting smoking is not going to be a priority if they're homeless. Quit smoking if they have no job, it's not going to be a priority. So I guess for me, these social determinants of health are huge for us in New Jersey, in the urban areas. And so how do we link some of these health metrics to their appropriate social counterparts? Yeah. So someone was talking about in the psychiatric hospital, for them to get outside to get fresh air, they're encouraged to smoke. Even if you check that off as a physician in a box and said, yes, I asked him about smoking, in a way it's almost so what, because there's a systemic problem back in the hospital. And so I think there need to be linkages, and I guess I'm not, as a new person, not sure how do we connect these dots across disciplines, not just within the health discipline.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I really appreciate your comments, and I think the SNF Alliance folks have said, too, in terms of, I mean, you know, the other sort of concern is when you talk about that particular high-risk population, you know, how do you get a survey to them in the first place? Like, you know, for the second measure, it's like if you're relying on mail and telephone and you have a significant proportion of homeless folks or people who don't speak any of the first few languages that CAPS is translated into, you're going to miss a significant chunk anyway of the people that you're concerned about. Your point's well taken.
Alice, if I could just follow up on that for a second. One of our members, Amerigroup, had a paper commissioned last fall looking specifically at the impact of social determinants of health on STAR measures and plan ratings. And I'd be happy to get you the link to that if, you know, other people would like to see it. This was something I was going to bring up in my comments tomorrow, that we have to figure out how to get the social determinants of health linked in. And one of the things that one of our providers from Kaiser, Dr. Warren Taylor, who will be speaking, was talking about is Kaiser's starting to do zip code analysis so they can figure out who's living in those zip codes, figure out what the problems are in those zip codes.
We're doing the same thing in Trenton.
Okay, great.
Any Camden geomapping certain trends.
So that you can find out what you need to do in order to change the outcome.
And what's the right intervention.
Exactly.
Because it may vary from zip code to zip code.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I think this was helpful in terms of just, like, before we go, you know, plunge into the rest of the 50 measures, it's helpful to, like, get everybody grounded in the what is it that we're tackling and why and how it fits and doesn't fit. You know, we need to remember that we have sort of a ultimate goal of coming up with a family of measures that I think Tom said on the phone could be as many as 60, but it's not going to be 500. So, you know, as we go through these different measures, you want to think about which ones are maybe the best fit and to realize, again, that there's still going to be gaps. And so as we move through, we're going to be identifying gaps, too, and say some of these measures are just not going to work for, you know, people who you can't get to with mail and telephone combination surveys. Some of these are just not going to fit for people who, you know, aren't able to answer a survey even if you could locate them in the first place, or for, you know, people who it's not their highest priority. So, you know, with all of that said, you know, are these two measures ones that you could support moving ahead into the family, knowing that they wouldn't be applied across maybe every single part of the family? So, Joan.
Taking this conversation, I guess one thing just in terms of your last comment is the potential of saying, okay, well, maybe this could be in the family that then needs to kind of get re-looked at, because I think one of our concerns in this work group all the way along is that based on the dual eligible beneficiary population, there weren't a lot of great measures that cut across systems, that cut across populations, mm-hmm. that cut across the needs, which are often psychosocial needs and not health needs or clinical needs in that way. And so one of my concerns, you know, continues that the gaps are great. And so I think we just have to be very wary that if we're sort of choosing measures that are going to get at the questions asked but not at really the sort of priority needs to really get to the triple aim, we will have missed the boat in a way.
Thanks. Susan?
So do we need two measures of anything? Would we be trying to prioritize one, given the need to have so many different measures? Would we really be suggesting one or the other rather than two or three?
The reason that there are two is that the first measure, the level of analysis there is at the physician level, and the next one is at the health plan level. So depending on where you are in the system, you might be interested in the tobacco use rates and the process that is being followed by both of those types of entities. And that's where we get the family concept that, you know, and maybe one of these hospital measures will come through endorsement and we'll be able to look at it there too. So actually getting down to one isn't the goal as much as it's sort of covering the continuum of care as best we can with measures that are going to be effective. If they're not going to be effective, by no means should they need to be supported just because they're a different level of analysis. But
So on the health plan versus the the clinician level of analysis, if the first one's administrative data, wouldn't you capture all the health plans in that? These are all voluntary, right? This is like, you know, so Massachusetts is doing it in their demonstration. They're collecting this on everybody. It's an administrative data set, right? They're doing some counseling on everybody. They're, you know, it's in their system. There's at least, I don't know how many plans, at least two in Massachusetts, right? Maybe it's three or four. And so you collect that data. Is there anything else that's different that we should know? I'm leaning toward the administrative side personally. I think it seems like a better value wherever you can.
It's endorsed to be used at the practice level. Sometimes measures are used for purposes beyond what they've been reviewed for by one of an NQF committee. So it appears as if Massachusetts has found a way to aggregate the data and look at it at a higher level of analysis. But we don't want to, you know, speculate on that too much here. Deb, do you have something to add?
Because it's endorsed as a plan level measure, it means that the measure is able to discriminate between plan A and plan B.
Not.
Can I just ask a general policy measure process question that I'll defer to NQF, and I understand may not have an answer, but I'm trying to figure out how this work fits into the work of the MPC. And so if the Measure Policy Council is coming up with the core set of measures, having identified priority measure concept areas for the entire Department of Health and Human Services, and then identifying those measures for those priority measure concepts, that basically tells all the agencies, if you measure in this concept, you will use this measure. And if they identify the measure for tobacco use for that purpose, then I always kind of envisioned that this may just be in my mind that the MPC measures are the floor that then the map would kind of support and build around. But I realize it's kind of fluid. It goes up and down. And it's not like this is that. It's this evolving process. So if we know that the MPC selected a certain measure, do we then select that also? Or do we then just accept that that's part of the MPC set and wrap around that? Or is that just there's no real process in place and this is all kind of government process think stuff for us to deal with? And I don't even know, to be honest, if those MPC measures, NQF even has those MPC measures, or if they're still internal with the department. So I'm trying to figure
it out. Not tagged here what that group has selected. So
it's
if you have knowledge about what measures have been
I do, and we try to figure out, do we share them, do we not? And it was kind of like it's neither public nor private, you know, like they're not like on the website advertised, but they're not like confidential. I mean, the NQF, the 002A is an MPC measure, and so I think that's just important for our group to know as we grapple with this going forward.
Before we turn to Deb, could you just explain a little bit more to the group about what
so talking I'm about? Not on the MPC. My colleagues who are in my office are represent HRSA in the Measure Policy Council, and it's basically the Department of Health and Human Services. I'll defer to Deb then. She's on the MPC.
I am on the Policy Council. The Policy Council is internal to Health and Human Services to align and minimize, reduce burden, to measure things in a consistent way when possible. The role of the MAP is external stakeholders, people outside of the government saying to Health and Human Services, this is what we think, so that we can all work in partnership to come up with what the measure should be. It's not just the government saying, do this. It's, you know, it's a combination of all. And so it's an evolving process.
It's evolving. I just didn't know if there's value in having that shared in this discussion or if it's completely kept separate.
The measures that are currently actually used in the department are on the website for the National Quality Measure Clearinghouse. There's a subpart of that website that has an inventory of Health and Human Service measures. There's also an inventory of measures on the CMS website that's called the CMS Pipeline of Measures, which has all of the measures that are sort of in use at CMS. You know, so it's bigger than what is endorsed by NQF. So I do think that information is out there, and it is confusing, but we're really here to hear from all of you stakeholders.
Thank you. So, will of the group, do you want to take these two? Were there any in the rest of the list that anybody had any strong feelings about discussing and considering? Hey, Ann.
Hi, I just wanted to add a couple there. If there are survey-based measures, it's telling there might be some connection to survey-based measures on these items that proxy respondents are allowed. I know that got brought up earlier, but it's kind of a critical area for this group.
Oh, sorry. Can you say that? Say your question again really loud.
Sure.
So is that better?
Yes, thank you.
Can you hear me? Okay. So this got brought up earlier, and it's partly a question and partly kind of a comment, that it sounded like these were heat expenditures, Alice, but it also sounded like there was a survey component to them, so it wasn't quite clear. But if there is a survey component to them, that proxy respondents are allowed. I know somebody mentioned that as an important aspect of this population, and typically proxy respondents have not been allowed to encapsulate items. So,
which kind of respondents were not allowed? Oh, proxy respondents. Okay.
Proxy.
Yes. Got it. Thank you.
So
the second one is a survey measure using traditional kind of CAPS methodology, right? So Leonardo.
So my two reactions would be, I mean, I think of the seven here, these two clearly, the first one makes a lot of sense. The second one makes sense if you bring in the health plan, what we call level of analysis. My two comments would be, first, that going forward, while it is important to have measures, I think, that do health plan level of analysis, given where we're going with duals demos, and states through other things that are not dual demos are doing similar things. But a lot of what is happening right now is states moving towards bringing managed care into institutional care and HCBS care and facility care, so that you would really want to be able to have a health plan measure that could also do facility level measurement, because that would be a big gap given where it looks like the system is going. That would be my first comment. And my second comment would be that the all of this, so the first measure satisfies a lot of things we care about, right? Like it's both ambulatory and inpatient. It deals with behavioral health, so it has a lot of good things about it. But that doesn't really speak to whether it's an effective measure. And I think this goes a little bit to Ruth's point that what the numerator looks like, whether somebody was screened once in the last 2 years, I would question whether we would think that was really a very high bar. So my point is that I think that even if the measure structurally fits nicely into what we want, I think there still might be a gap in the sense that it's just kind of a low bar.
So let's see if we have like consensus about the first measure, 0028. Everybody feel comfortable keeping that on the list for serious mental illness and substance use disorder subpopulations? Okay, yes, nods all around. Anybody on the phone have a strong disagreement? Okay, 0027, we might need a show of hands, but let's see if there's nods on including 0027 with all the caveats and the notes about the gaps and what it doesn't actually address. Nods. Okay, all right, good. All right, Sarah, we can move on to the next topic.
Seven measures down, 43 to go. Next topic is, no, very good discussion, though, and that we will move faster through the rest of these. I think we're all getting the hang of the type of discussion we want to have. The next topic is alcohol and substance use. There's six available measures, and again, the staff picked out two. So this is section number two. The two staff picks are NQF-0004, initiation and engagement of alcohol and other drug dependence treatment, as well as NQF number 2152, preventive care and screening, unhealthy alcohol use screening, and brief counseling. Measure number four hopefully looks familiar to you. It's been in our core set and the starter set. It has been previously emphasized by this group because it looks at engagement with treatment. So it's getting closer to being an outcome measure. There are a number of other programs that it's used in, such as the initial core set for Medicaid-eligible adults, the Meaningful Use Program for health professionals, and the Physician Quality Reporting System. It's been proposed as a Medicaid health home measure. It's been picked up by the California, Illinois, Massachusetts, Ohio, and Washington state demonstrations, and it's also a HEDIS measure. So this one has quite a bit of momentum behind it from another number of areas. Measure 2152 is submitted to the Behavioral Health Endorsement Project. It has not been reviewed by that steering committee yet. However, when we heard about this measure at our last meeting, everyone was very much in favor of it, so we put it in the core set with the recommendation that it stay there if it's endorsed. So this measure captures screening for unhealthy alcohol use and if the patient receives brief counseling, if they screen positive. The measure can be collected using electronic health records. And again, I think we'll know a little bit more about it when it goes through the steering committee, but we have some representation on that steering committee within this group, so I think we can stay aligned there. I guess, Mady or Susan, if you want to start us off, go ahead.
Okay, well, for the first measure has been around for a while, the initiation and engagement. And what's important about that simply, it's simple, is that what it involves is identifying a patient through screening and then making sure that subsequent to that, if they need treatment, treatment is initiated. That's the critical piece of that. For the second measure, what's most important to know, which somehow I don't see on here, is that the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, again, last week or the week before last, came out with another report supporting screening for unhealthy alcohol use and brief counseling. So they keep U.S. Preventive Services Task Force keeps pushing it, there's sufficient, according to them, they wouldn't support it if there wasn't sufficient clinical trials and sufficient research to support that measure. So I don't know that I have much else to say about it.
I'll also add that the measures not highlighted by staff are submitted, again, still pending for further review by the steering committee. So that's part of the justification for those that aren't highlighted.
Oh, sorry, Deb.
One of my jobs at the department these days is to oversee some behavioral health quality measure development efforts, and the I'll point out that the SUB 1, 2, 3, and 4 are all measures that were specifically designed for an inpatient psychiatric setting, but that SUB 1 and SUB 4 are currently proposed in the current rule for inpatient psychiatric settings. And it's my understanding from the Joint Commission that the measures that were submitted for clearance did include testing in one IPS, but that was all. That the SUB 1 through 4 measures are really acute care hospital measures. They're not IPF measures or ambulatory care settings.
Leonardo.
I didn't even remember bringing it up. But I did have a question. Care setting for the second one, for 2.2, why is care setting hospital for that? Can you explain? That's what's confusing me about that.
Yeah, although it seems like a practice that could be applied more widely, this was developed...
I think it's on the error.
Is it?
Okay. That's correct.
All right. I'll look at that.
Because I think the AMA PCPI endorsed it for actually for physician offices and outpatients.
Yeah, it could be that row and the row below it, that L's
got reversed. I think it's reversed, right.
Oh.
The next one is the Joint Commission measure that should say hospital.
We can correct that.
That would, a lot of things would make.
So given that we had already included these two, I would kind of hope that everybody's pretty happy with them. We've talked about them on a couple of rounds of conversation, so I'm looking for a nodding row of heads. Yes, Sean?
Clarification, I mean, just to understand the process. What is the downside of not selecting any of these measures? I mean, is it that the crowd out other measures that are coming through the pipeline? Is there, you know, a cap? Is 60, that's it? So we got to, like, minimize? You know, I'm just trying to understand what would be the reason. You know, what am I selecting? What level of scrutiny do we need to apply to selecting these based on what else might be available?
Right. So tomorrow, when we get to the end of the conversation, we'll go back and take a look at all of the list, right? So we'll have an opportunity tomorrow to go back through and say, did we hit the rows where we had a chance to? Did we address gaps where we had a chance to? And so we'll have one. This is like the conversation at this moment won't preclude that, oh my gosh, we really missed the opportunity to put in inpatient-related measures or whatever. And 60 isn't an absolute, no.
Okay, so in other words, there's, you know, lots of questions about social determinants of health and all kinds of stuff around recovery measures that are being developed in mental health, for instance, that may be coming up through the pipeline over the next several years, perhaps. And so does this, if we crowd out, is this going to crowd out some of those if we don't leave room for them, for those kinds of things to come up? Or how would that work? Would it replace things? Would it just be added?
At NQF, we hear a couple of concerns when measure lists get too long. There is effort required to collect every measure, so we want to be careful with those resources. We also want to ensure that measures that we ask people to collect data on and report on and other people to analyze and consumers to look at are meaningful for the dual eligible population and not just, you know, another data point for the sake of having another data point. Is it something that's important enough to measure? Then you should select a measure. If it doesn't, you know, rise to that level, we can move on.
We'll start at the Ruth end and work our way up the table. So, yeah, Ruth.
One thing that we've encountered in Trenton is a high level, few residents have primary care physicians, so there's a high level of emergency department utilization. In fact, ER utilization is about 54% higher than the national average in Trenton. And so a lot of those admissions are substance abuse and alcohol related. So and that creates this sort of revolving door through the emergency department. And so again, I think, you know, I don't have an issue with any of these substance abuse measures that are here, but I feel they don't necessarily tie to, at least to my reality of work and practice in Trenton. So if a person has come through the emergency department, I don't even see that sort of listed. Two, if they keep coming back for the same problem, and we've just received a grant from DMOS to do ESPRIT for over 5 years, so we're going to be deploying that in the outpatient clinics and then in emergency departments to screen and then link them to ongoing care, but I don't see metrics here that sort of, again, connect the dots along the continuum of care. So it's a good thing. I can't argue with it, but it in a way it feels sort of like mom and apple pie because it doesn't get to some of the core, deeper issues that really drive utilization and drive poor health outcomes in our city.
Thanks, Cheryl.
We're rogue with the table. We both keep knocking it. I think I'll try to focus on Sean's question and also come back to some of what Ruth was saying. And what we're really hoping to get out of this is to focus on what's really important for duals. And there are lots of measures, all Medicare measures, all Medicaid measures, which are currently measuring dual activity and dual quality. But what we're trying to do is be fairly disciplined and focused on what's really important, regardless of whether that measure actually exists or not. So and that gives an opportunity for that input to us. We're starting on this. We're embarking. We're beginning to focus and take the input that comes from this group and include it when we look at dual eligibles and when we look at what's really important. So that should be a fairly high bar, because if what's truly important are things that don't exist, then perhaps that's where we need to focus our efforts, as opposed to on a bunch of things that exist that are okay. And, yeah, we can measure them, but is that really what's important? Does that give us the highest value? And as far as what Ruth is bringing up, that's great feedback for us. Yeah, I like this measure. It's a good measure. It doesn't go far enough. It's missing the ER setting. So for us, we know that maybe that is truly what's important, but it also needs to include other settings. So we'll take all of that into consideration. But that's sort of, it's difficult because you can't put a number on what the appropriate number of measures is, but that's sort of the balance of what we're trying to get input on.
Valerie.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on what Cheryl was saying. Our members have talked for a long time about meaningful versus measurable. There's a lot of things out there that are measurable that don't necessarily have a lot of value for a particular population. And our plans are increasingly concerned about data burden, because as SNPs, we do all the MA reporting. We do SNP-specific reporting of measures that haven't been used for looking at outcomes or, you know, changing the way our members do business. And then if they're duals, they also have the Medicaid reporting. When Sarah spoke at our meeting last month, she indicated that one of the ideas was to identify a number of measures that the plans would then be able to select among. So to the extent that we're picking measures and saying this would be really helpful for, you know, severe and persistent mental illness versus cognitive impairment, you know, we're all for having a large set that are available for us to use, but if everything that's selected is a requirement, then that becomes a problem for us. So I really appreciate what Cheryl was saying.
Thanks. Clark.
I wanted to build on Cheryl's comments, but it was Sarah's response to Sean. So tomorrow, I think it would be helpful if we had some time where we take the endorsed measures and we talk about their expanded use. I was assigned care coordination measures, and I was saying, man, these are so limited. It's, you know, one condition and one setting, and it makes sense to apply it to the universe. So, then given Cheryl's guidance, that what makes sense for the population of people who are dually eligible, I'd like that opportunity for us to revisit the list and be able to say that's nice, but it's limited and should be expanded. We've been discussing that issue all morning. And then I just feel compelled, because I've heard data overload and burden from the health plan folks, so as a consumer representative, so I know the health plan folks go back and you're going to be asked, why did you include that one? Leo and I and a few others are going to go back and be asked, why weren't these 20 included? These are really important to a subpopulation. And so it's a balancing act, but I just felt I needed to balance that observation that there's the burden and data overload. There's also, this has to work for the population and each of the subpopulations. That's all. Thank you.
All right.
Maybe. I wanted to speak directly to the issue that Ruth raised, because I don't know that this committee has an understanding of the issue about where these measures end up getting applied and who and what the issue is with emergency rooms. The screening and brief intervention measures that's here and the initiation and engagement measures began in emergency rooms. that's where they were first looked at. And the problem that arose, which still exists in at least half of the states in this country, is that there are statutes, UPPL statutes, on the books that say that if you identify alcohol as an issue in an emergency room, the plan, the insurance plan, whether it's a managed care plan or not, doesn't have to pay for any aspect of your treatment in the emergency room or thereafter. So you come in having had a motorcycle accident, alcohol is identified through a screening, and in most states in this country, the insurance plans do not have to pay for your broken arm or for your alcohol treatment or anything else.
Do you mean like the car insurance people who would be covering your motor vehicle, or do you mean your health insurance?
Your health insurance. Your health insurance. Now, when I was in the government, in the Center for Substance Abuse Treatment, that was one of the issues that we addressed and began to send a few people around the United States to state legislatures to speak on that very issue to get them to change those statutes. That's an ongoing effort. But when ESPIRT or screening and brief interventions is done in emergency rooms, the reluctance that many staff have for putting it in the record, and the reason it looks like, oh, nothing's happening in emergency rooms, is because they don't dare. We are still in this country having a problem with being willing to identify alcohol and drug disorders and get them treated. And, you know, it's an uphill battle, and those of us who are in this field continue. I think Clark knows this issue well. I mean, but it's something we all have to be aware of, that's part of the underlying issue about why it looks like these measures are disconnected from settings. It's just a problem that we have to continue to deal with. It's also interesting to me to note that the research on readmissions to hospitals that has been done as a result of the Medicare no-no-no policy, you know, we're not going to pay for readmissions, many hospitals have taken a look at what is driving their readmissions, Montefiore Hospital in New York and other places, and it is alcohol, drugs, and psychosis are the top three readmission issue, huh?
No, I just said, and the all-cause plan readmission measure specifically excludes them from the demand.
Right. You know, so that's a good thing that it's been identified, as far as I'm concerned, because it may drive people to begin to think about what they're going to do to treat these disorders. On the other hand, if it's excluded from the denominator still, you know where we still are, behind the eight ball on these measures. So it's just something the members of this committee should be aware of.
Thank you. Okay.
So on a gap thing, right, the question is, what are the services that need to be available for people, right? And like, how do we measure whether, you know, any of these plans are providing the service, like peer support services and other services that are really helpful to help people engage, you know, community health workers who are also peers, et cetera, that, you know, maybe there's another way to work with this instead of going to the emergency room, for instance. Like, just an example. But those are the kinds of things that we need measures for.
All right, so once again, with the caveats and the gaps noted and our inability to measure all aspects that we would like, Jim?
and just one last caveat is that a lot of the measures and the needs of these are actually societal. They really don't belong to anybody at all right now. And when I say most of the patients that I see in the emergency room, my frequent users, don't have any place to go but the emergency room. There is no sobering center that will take somebody who's stumbling drunk. They go to the emergency room. Those are really the bottom line. You find a handful of communities that'll accept people into a safe environment. They have social support groups like Volunteers of America that'll actually run these, but they'll specifically exclude anybody that is tipsy, too tipsy, and they'll go to the emergency room. So really the measure is got to be a lot bigger. It's more of this, where we're trying to go is alternate locations where people can be, and they just practically don't exist today.
Okie doke. Laura?
Just to piggyback onto that, because there, just to let you know too, there were like 92 measures chosen for the duals demonstration. So parsimony is, and a lot of them to be developed, and they're all very good. I really support all the measures. And the substance abuse issue, though, this was included in the duals measure, but substance abuse is actually a carve out to Medicaid. And it's carved out to the Department of Public Health in California. So I think that's the gap that Jim was alluding to. So, but nonetheless, it's important and it needs to be measured. But just so you know, it's not always, like Jim said, the health plan. It's a society issue right now. And it depends on the community, back to your issue, and how every community is going to take care of these folks when they come in.
Ruth, I'm going to let you have the last word on this, and then we're going to move on. Is there an opportunity to capture some of this feedback that's in the discussion that can then be sent back to the appropriate stakeholders, so that even if we, you know, ratify some subset of all that's here, that there's deeper context for them? Because I would be concerned, because I think all this discussion has been excellent and important, but I'd hate to see that lost and then metrics that may not be as useful to folks in the field will be what's promulgated and continue to be promulgated. And then I guess the other thing, is there an opportunity within NQF, maybe it's a different working group, not this one, that really begins to look at social determinants of health and sort of this integration across medical and other social psychological services? Go ahead.
Yeah. I'll start and answer questions backwards. We've had ongoing projects about health disparities and disparities measurement, and some beginning work in social determinants, although the evidence for those types of measures is different than a lot of the guideline based measures, which are more typical. So I would say that's an emerging area of measurement. In response to your first comment, we are all taking very careful notes about the discussion, and we'll capture all the nuances in future reports. But I would also ask all of you to make particular note of action items that you would like to request of CMS, of health plans, of consumers, of whatever stakeholder groups. If you have something, you know, very finite related to a measure development, measure implementation, we will have an opportunity to voice those towards the end of the meeting tomorrow. And I'd be happy to take anything in writing as well. Thanks.
Okay, so again, looking for consensus on the two measures that are currently in our evolving core set and starter set, that we recommend them for these subpopulations of interest today. Nodding. Okay. Going once, going twice. Anybody on the phone want to disagree? Okay. Now the job gets a little harder because we're moving into a couple areas where, or one area where we don't have a staff pick, so hepatitis C.
We have two possible measures for hepatitis C. Neither one was felt to really rise to the same level as other measures by the staff. First of all, neither one is currently endorsed. They are both process measures. If you look at the description, for the first one, it's the percentage of patients over 18 with the diagnosis of chronic hep C who are prescribed a specific therapy within a 12-month reporting period. So this seemed a bit narrow to us to elevate to the measure list. However, we didn't want to lose it completely because this is a condition really associated with groups of alcohol and substance use disorders. So if anyone would feel strongly about including one or the other of the hepatitis measures, you'd be free to make your case.
Nobody's jumping up to defend these measures. Joan?
I don't know anything about hepatitis C and alcoholism, but if I recall, there's also links between hepatitis C and institutionalization, and it was sort of a big issue among the developmental disability community going back a lot of years, because that's when I remember the conversations from. And so these measures might be too narrow to the issue, because I think it's one of these things that connects to institutionalization also.
Okay. Ruth? Comment? No? Oh, lady?
Just one comment. The second measure, just the one that is counseling with regard to the risk of alcohol consumption, if I was going to support anything, it would be that one. But the in any setting where you have identified Hep C, which is very identified with people with HIV often, and very identified with a group that we are going to be having to deal with in health reform, which is offenders who are reentering the community and who will now be eligible for Medicaid, single males, and who are going to represent a very high proportion of those with substance use disorders who also either have HIV or hepatitis C. We know the data. The data are available on offenders who will be reentering, and we know that they're loaded with hepatitis C. That is not to say that we have to endorse one of these measures, but I don't know what committee, if any, is dealing with the issues of HIV and other infectious diseases. But somebody needs to deal with them, because they are connected to substance use disorders for sure.
Jim, go ahead.
Fact, the CDC now recommends that everybody born between 1945 and 1965 be screened for hepatitis C. The baby boomer generation is the generation that's at particular risk and oftentimes are not diagnosed, so just so you know, that's just come out in the last year.
So I'm going to capture the gap then as a screening gap, because you would have to have already been diagnosed with Hep C to be in the denominator for the first measure. That's potentially also more relevant to the general Medicaid population for the reasons Mady raised than it is a dual eligible issue. Valerie?
Sarah, my member that represents people with severe and persistent mental illness raised this as a measure, hepatitis C, screening and prevention training that they would support. About 8% of their members have hepatitis C.
All right. So that's helpful to move that issue forward. Not seeing a lot of support for these measures being in our family, though. So we're going to move ahead to depression.
Okay. There are...
Yes.
Is a gap. That brings us to depression. We have 9 measures related to just depression, and actually the staff picked out 6 of them. There's a number of really good metrics here. We have supported more rather than less because they sort of are active at different points in the continuum of care and target different parts of the screening and treatment of this condition. So I'll try to move a little quickly here. The first is measure 418, preventive care and screening, screening for clinical depression and follow-up plan. This is in our core measure set and has been identified as a starter measure as well. This group has liked that it has the follow-up element once someone screens positive. It can be collected through claims or electronic health records. It's in a number of programs, such as the Medicaid Adult Core Set, Meaningful Use, Medicare Shared Savings for ACOs, Physician Feedback, Physician Quality Reporting System, and it's used by HRSA. It's been recommended as a Medicaid Health Home Measure. Five state demonstrations, and also the Bridges to Excellence private program. Measure 712 is depression and utilization of the PHQ-9 tool. This measure focuses on using a well-known, standardized, validated tool to diagnose depression. The patient completes this instrument, so it's a patient-reported outcome, and depression is a very high-impact condition, so it meets that box as well. This measure is in the Meaningful Use program and the PQRS program, and also used by the state of Minnesota. Measure 103, Adult Major Depressive Disorder, Comprehensive Depression Evaluation, Diagnosis, and Severity. This has a comprehensive evaluation component. It addresses the key issue of screening for SMI within the population of individuals who have substance use or possibly dementia diagnoses. These measure specifications have been submitted to the Behavioral Health Endorsement Project, and there's a little bit of alignment here, too, with use in the Physician Feedback Program and the Physician Quality Reporting System. Measure 104 is closely related, but this one is on the topic of suicide risk assessment, something that was flagged as a key issue. Measure 105 relates to medication management specific to antidepressants. This measure is specified for the health plan or the integrated delivery system use. It can be collected from claims or electronic medical records. This has a whole host of federal programs in which it's used, the Medicaid set, meaningful use program, Medicare Part C measures, physician feedback, physician quality reporting system, and value-based payment. It's a measure currently reported by special needs plans. It was selected by four states for their dual demos, and it's in a number of private health plans as well. Finally, measure 710, depression remission at 12 months. This is an outcome measure of recovery from depression. So this is also collected through the use of the PHQ-9 tool. It is included in meaningful use and the Physician Quality Reporting System programs. There's a similar measure, number 711, which is depression remission at 6 months. And so we were sort of favoring the sustained control of depression, so we went with the longer time frame, but that's something the group could discuss. Although this measure of depression remission does exclude patients with bipolar. So since the floor is open, we had two different reviewers assigned to the depression area. I see there one of them would like to start. Joan.
I just really looked at these this morning. I was challenged by the enormity of the spreadsheet and my computer skills did not match. And I guess what I want to say overall to these just kind of matches the conversation we're already having. So I'm looking at this and thinking, this CMI and bits, except that SMI, wrong acronyms. However, these are not addressing the needs of people with serious mental illness. These are screening tools, and they don't they're not measures of sort of chronicity and all of the issues that address people's longer healthcare needs. So that is kind of my overall comments, because even if you look at the 418, it embraces basic screening and it eliminates all the people who are kind of in the emergency room in a high need state. So I think that kind of creates a gap. 712 talks about the exclusion of people in nursing homes. I don't believe that's true anymore. I think the PHQ-9 was included as part of the redesign of the MDS 3.0 that went into operation in October 2011. That's kind of my overall, that we're not really getting to any of the issues that would get people to get better health care in a broader view.
Thank you. Deb?
I have a related comment to Jones, and that is why weren't the cognitively impaired in the IDD population included on here, which I think are actually more important for screening for depression than the seriously mentally ill, which are already typically, because they're seriously mentally ill, they have a diagnosis, they're in the system. It's those that we know have high levels of comorbidity that really need to be screened. So
I'd like to support that. You know, it is not the FMI population that should be the focus of this particular measure. I mean, I have, if we go through all seven, I have some differences with the other measures about their relevance and appropriateness to the various populations. But on this first measure, this is not for FMI. This is for everybody else.
There's a slide you included in the background package on the demographics of the IDDD population, and mental illness is stark and in the co-occurrence. So those co-occurrence data that's in the packet, that's the gap between the limited measures and the need of the population.
I do have a comment, though. If we are talking about the SMI group, it would seem to me that one of the things that you absolutely definitely want to at least achieve is that you have control of whatever you are trying to treat. So it would seem to me that 105, which is the antidepressant medication management, would be something that would be applicable, that we should consider.
I think Valerie was there.
Yeah, I'm guessing that Warren Taylor may address this in his presentation, but on our call, a couple of our physicians said that they like the PHQ-9 measure. One reason is because some depression measures look at the persistence of medication use and whether it improved outcomes, whereas the PHQ-9 allows you to account for adjustments in medication and dosages and look at the impact not only on depression but on other health-related health conditions, and that also like it for cognitive impairment, as Ms. Potter was mentioning, and that even if you can't treat something like dementia, that at least it allows you to identify what level of dementia the person is at and take that into account in their care plan.
So, other issue that's not here are some of these measures are good measures for caregivers, because the issues of depression in caregivers is also a major factor for all of the population.
Yeah, go ahead, Tom.
I just had a general comment, just kind of summary looking at all the depression measures. In terms of the descriptions, the majority of the measures are really focused on 18 and older, I believe. It's only the first one, 418, that's 12 and younger. So that's just a consideration. And also, I know we have moved on from our discussion on the alcohol and tobacco, but those measures also are focused on 18 and older, and we know health behaviors often start earlier than that. So just something to acknowledge and be cognizant of in terms of, as we're going through these, looking at the descriptions and ages. So.
We haven't been probably as worried about the younger dual. I mean, there's a handful, you know, there's 16, 17-year-old dual eligibles who have work history and they, you know, for whatever reason, they get into a pathway of dual eligibility. There's not many, but there's a handful. People have cards up, but you've already made your comments. Oh, Sean, go ahead.
So on the medication management one, the focus is, you know, really on compliance, it seems like, with a particular recommendation. And one of the things that, you know, SAMHSA's, at least the patent isn't here, I don't think, but SAMHSA's been really working, doing a lot of work on shared decision-making around this, and that's really, from the perspective of a quality of life, which is an underlying thing here, that seems to be perhaps a gap. Again, I'm sorry, lots of gaps, but I think that's something to look at, to think about, that the adherence to a particular a regimen, prescribed regimen, is pretty low, frankly, right, in psychotropic meds. And a lot of that has to do with quality of life factors. A lot of the sort of side effects, the unwanted effects, put it that way, of the medication. And so a well-developed implemented shared decision-making process can really help with that. We know this. So that's thinking about measuring that somehow, or coming up with some ideas on how to do that would be, I think, more effective than simply, does the person take the meds or not?
Maybe.
Are we expecting these to be endorsed by this group as a group, or are we going to go through these measures individually? Because
one by one.
Okay.
We can start to do that now, unless there are further general comments. Go ahead.
There's also needs to be something, and maybe it's a little bit later in some of the other categories, but in particular, thinking about the elderly, the amount of polypharmacy that takes place, and so once if you've diagnosed depression, but I think there needs to be something, just not only managing their antidepressant medication, but I think there needs to be something about managing their medication, because there's tremendous side effects, tremendous mortality and morbidity from drug interactions, and there's huge costs associated with polypharmacy.
Thanks. That is a later topic. We'll get to it tomorrow. All right, I'm just going to go through these one by one in the interest of time. I'll sort of recap what we heard specifically. Number 418 is a good measure, but not for people already identified as having serious mental illness. More important to screen and make a follow-up plan for individuals with IDDD or caregivers. So I think the group would continue to include this. And substance use. Okay. 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 The following measure, 712, utilization of the PHQ-9 tool. I heard a few people speak in favor of this, particularly the special needs plans. Is there disagreement about moving it forward?
This also relates to sort of the larger populations and not just SMI in terms of the PHQ-9. Mm-hmm. It's used a lot. I mean, that's where, like, in nursing homes they're using it with people with cognitive impairment.
All right. We'll expand the population tagging on that one as well. Number 103, no one made a specific comment, so maybe you're shaking your head. Perhaps we would not move this one forward.
I think it's duplicative in many respects to some of the others. I just don't think it's necessary. If we're, how many measures are we going to, for depression, are we going to do here?
Okay. The following suicide risk assessment. Suicide had come up as a key quality issue.
You should expand that in terms of the population. It's not just SMIs.
Okay, so we will not move 104 forward either. 105, depression medication management, we did have people in support of. So hearing no objection, we will include that. And
again, these are for larger populations than just the SMI, because
right,
depression treatment for people with cognitive impairment
is
a big issue.
Right. Depression as a serious mental illness is sort of, altering the way we came at these, but point taken. And finally, 710, the remission of depression symptoms at 12 months, seeing some nodding as an outcome measure. Disagreement?
Again, I think if you're using the PHQ-9, it will get at the issue of, and we're supporting that measure, then it will get at the issue of remission. 6, 12, it's always used. It just keeps, so I just don't think it's necessary to have another measure.
I think one of the reasons we might have included it, and we'll have to check our spreadsheet, is that it might be a different level of analysis, which would be the reason to have two measures of a similar topic, so that it could be used at different points in the system. And we'll sort of clean that up on the back end.